And so we'll begin. Ah, there you go. Right there. So, if you'll recall in the first lecture when I got things launched, we discussed and learned a little bit about geodesy, and we learned this important concept that if we don't mind too much detail, we can deal with the Earth as a sphere, as a spherical model. If so, convenient numbers to remember are 40 million meters, the diameter around the Earth. If we go with an ellipsoid, we can do a reasonably good job of mapping with the ellipsoid. That'll allow us to take something that's only a small degree, about 1 in 300 off of a sphere, and do modeling. But if we need to go to extreme mapping, we need to go to the geoid. So the first step there is that what you might call the Earth model, mapping the Earth onto a model of the Earth. Once we've decided how we're going to do that snap, the next thing we need to do is to take something as large as the Earth and make it the size of a map. And that's the scaling transformation. Today I want to talk about the scale transformation. Okay, the sort of theme of what I want to talk about here is transformations in general. So what do we have here? Well, we've got two maps, two images. They're both related to fires in the Santa Barbara region. On the left-hand side, we see a satellite image, the way it would be from space, of a part of the Earth. Now, I often refer to these as dumb images because they're just pictures. They don't represent any intelligence about what's happening. On the right-hand side, we have a Fire Service and Forest Service collaborative map showing fire burn areas and so on. So an enormous amount of interpretation has gone in to the map that's on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, we have really very little information. We have an extent, the part of the world in which we're interested, and we have perhaps a content theme. And here, visible light is being obscured by smoke. On the right-hand side, all we have is a set of symbols, a collection of symbols, different colors, different fonts, different texts, and so on. And to get there, we have to go through a transformation. So that arrow is my symbolic representation of a transformation. Something has to go in, something happens, and something comes out. That's an operation we're going to see time and time again over the course of the quarter. Here's another way to think about it. This is the way I'm putting it in the new book that I'm working on right now. We've got three critical transformations that we need to deal with immediately. There's the section of the world or the part of it with which we're going to deal. The scale transformation, what we're going to talk about today, which bring things down to the size of the map as opposed to the size of the Earth. The projection transformation that we're going to spend the rest of the week on. The next two lectures on. And then we have to take the information that we've selected and convert it into a set of symbols. And that symbolic transformation is quite an important one. We're going to see quite a bit also of that in the strength of this class. Okay, ideally we want to go not just to the map, but we want to go all the way to the mind of the person that's interpreting and reading the map. So we're going to, if we do the full set of transformations, we're going to start with the Earth or part of the Earth, we're going to do the scale transformation, the projection, symbolization and representation, and then the last transformation is the reading and interpretation. We're going to do a fair amount of that in this class as well, primarily in the labs. We're going to look at the map, and we're going to use it to make a symbol in our minds of what's happening in the real world. The goal is to be able to understand what's happening. So in the end, we have a mental image of the Earth or a part of the Earth, and we're going to use that image because it's a very powerful thing to be able to use to store knowledge, to apply knowledge, or to do straightforward practical things like to navigate around in the real world. So let's start with some approximate numbers, and let's use a convenient number that we already know. Let's say that we have the full Earth, and if we imagine the full Earth is my convenient globe that I use extensively in my teaching. If we go all the way around the equator, we've traveled 40 million meters. Okay, so if we have a map at 1 to 40 million, then all the way around the equator on the globe, would be 1 meter on my map. We've applied this, what we'll see is a representative fraction. So if we take a particular map, say something like this globe, that might have a circumference of, let's say, a tenth of a meter, then we'll have been through a scale transformation of something like 1 to 400 million, or 1 to some other ratio. Okay. let's start within cartography. I'll define something called cartographic scale, because unfortunately the word scale gets used all the time in common language. Okay, the way it's used in common language is almost exactly the opposite of the way we use it in cartography. So I've stopped using it altogether, and I'll show you exactly why. So biology and ecology, for example, are always using scale much more generally. Generally, when they say large scale, they mean something that's extensive, that's global. You know, the range of sparrows in the entire world, it's enormous. It covers several continents. Small scale would be something very detailed or localized. So a one by one meter plot where they're counting all the plants in ecology, let's say, would be a small scale study. But our in cartography, we do the exact opposite. Small scale means maps with representative fractions with big numbers at the bottom, and therefore huge generalizations of the world. And large scale means maps that show a very small geographic extent, but in a lot of detail, exact opposite. So my solution to this is never use the word small scale or large scale. I refer to more detailed or less detailed scale, or more extensive, less extensive. But the scale does indeed give us a sense of how big, and if we just remember that number of 40 million meters, then we can pretty much calculate how big without having much information about the scale itself. So I'll define map scale or cartographic scale a little bit differently than what you might read in the dictionary, but this is the way I mean scale as I talk about this quarter. So map scale based on the representative fraction, and we're going to learn a lot about the representative fraction in the next few weeks, in the next few labs. So, but what do we mean by that? It's simply a ratio. It's a ratio of distances on the map, which are generally small distances, to this equivalent distance on the ground, which is going to be much larger, because cartography is about reducing, well, making it smaller. Now, if we use this representative fraction, we can express it in a number of different ways. I'm going to talk about those in detail. But we might, generally speaking, we'll give it as a ratio with a colon between the two parts, and we usually put one on the left-hand side and a ratio on the bottom side, a number on the other side. Those numbers are so commonly used that we often refer just to the bottom of the ratio, that number, when we refer to map series. So often if you're around Carto people, or what they gather now, they're called map heads after a popular book that came out this year. Map heads would talk about a map that was a 24K map. That would mean 1 over 24,000 scale map. Generally speaking, if we buy maps or get maps or use maps, we're looking at maps that are kind of in the range between about 1 to 1 million up to about 1 to 1,000. And those are sort of logical limits on what you might use in cartography. And 1 to 1 million, I'll show you a globe at 1 to 1 million in just a minute, but at 1 to 1 million, you can fit a whole state on a 1 to 1 million map easily. A 1 to 1,000, well, that's pretty detailed. A 1 to 1,000, if we make a map of this room, and let's say it's, let's guess that's 12 meters across, and we reduce that by 1,000, we're talking about 12 millimeters showing on the map. So 12 millimeters just to show the width of this room, beginning to look pretty detailed. Okay, digital and map, web maps don't necessarily have to adhere to these rigid restrictions on scale. So even though printed maps are normally done at standardized scales, like 1 to 50,000, 1 to 100,000, if we can zoom in and out at will using the internet or using a web browser, it's often said that these maps are scaleless. So we can choose any scale we like. We can just fill the screen with our particular map. But I want to make the pitch today that that's not strictly the case. Even though we can draw them at any scale that we choose, we can't change the content to make it fit the scale. So more about that, I'll return to that point at the end of the lecture. Okay? So we can enlarge and reduce maps and plot them at scales other than the original data. But in fact, you can't, as I usually say, the scale of a map when it's produced and converted into digital data sort of stamps itself on the map and affects every use to which that map can be put from then on. Okay, here's a non-scientific quiz. I've just given you the answer to this one. So we have a globe. Imagine this virtual, here's a virtual globe up here. It's going to be about the size of a beach ball, I would say. I take a tape measure and measure around its waist, and I come up with exactly 1 meter. That's a pretty large globe. It's about that big. So what is its approximate scale going to be? Well, we've already got enough information to deal with this one. We've taken a distance that we know and converted it by using a scale transformation. Let's do voting. Anybody think the answer is 1 inch to 5 feet? Thank you for your participation here. Anybody believe that it's 1 to 250,000? 1 to 24,000? 1 to 1 million? Incidentally, 1 to 1 million was the first scale that was ever proposed for a map of the entire Earth on a consistent mapping schema. It was proposed back in the late 1890s. 1 to 40 million? Yeah, okay, we're getting it, right? So it's 40 million meters around the Earth, and we reduce it. So it's 1 meter around, then we've reduced it by a scale of 1 to 40 million. So there's nothing magic about this, they're just simple ratios. So, you don't need that, you know. But here's the words that go along with it. But let me introduce this term here, RF. RF stands for representative fraction, and it is just simply that ratio that makes the scale. We can express it, and we've already seen it expressed in a couple of different ways. 1 inch to 1 mile, 1 inch to five miles, whatever. Generally speaking, we would like the units to be the same on both sides. So 1 meter to so many meters or whatever. Representative fraction, or RF here, is our simple little equation and something that I hope everybody's going to take away from today's lecture. The representative fraction is the map distance, that's the short one because we're measuring off the map, divided by the ground distance, the equivalent distance on the ground. That's going to be much larger. Okay, so this ratio is always going to be less than one. Well, generally speaking, it's always going to be less than one. If we drew a map at 1 to 1, it would be exactly the same size as the Earth, and probably not very functional. Just to put that in context, this is a picture of Eartha. Anybody ever been to visit Eartha? Yeah, all right, good. So you've been to Freeport, Maine, right? This is right on the main freeway up there. What is it, I-95, the corridor that goes way up the coastline of Maine and up through New Hampshire and so on, up through New York and New Jersey. If you just pull off there and visit the headquarters of the DeLorme Mapping Company, very popular outdoor recreation type mapping company, in their headquarters, with their extensive profits in selling maps and digital data, they've built this the world's largest freestanding rotating globe. Okay, and this is it. They dubbed it, they gave it a name, which is Eartha. And it's in the lobby of the building. It's in that sort of square thing. Very spectacular at night, I gather, because they light it up. But if you go inside, you can walk up on these walkways. And I believe there are 3 stories of walkways to get up to the top. Okay, it's pretty large. It turns a little faster than once a day. Otherwise, it'd be kind of dull. You wouldn't see the whole thing. But you can go up and look at it from different angles. And this is quite meticulously maintained at a scale of 1 to 1 million. Okay, so if we could just simply take that representative fraction of 1 to 1 million, shrink the Earth down by a million times, this is how big it would be. It's still fairly substantial. You know, we live on a smallish planet, but it's not that small. It does take quite a bit of effort to get around. So a nice scale, 1 to 1 million. 1 to 1 million maps, obviously, when we make them, we're going to have to project them because this is clearly a curved surface. We're going to want to put it onto a flat surface. And if we start mapping at 1 to 1 million, we're going to have to deal with this phenomenon of the Earth's curvature and how we put it onto the map.
Is the elevation exaggerated or is it?
The elevation, I believe, is slightly exaggerated. That's one of those interesting factoids that you can amuse your friends with. If the Earth was the size of a billiard ball, or we call it pool ball, the Earth's topography would be totally unnoticeable, and the entire atmosphere would be about the same thickness as a layer of shellac painted on the ball. So the atmosphere and the surface, the part of the Earth we live in, is really a very tiny piece of the Earth's structure. Okay, enough about Eartha, let's move on. We usually say within cartography that there's three ways. We've got three options with which to communicate scale on maps. And I'm going to fail, well, one of them is a given. We've already been talking about it, the representative fraction. But the last one, the graphic scale, has significance. I'll tell you just why in a little while. So first of all, representative fraction, we can represent it in all sorts of different ways. We can put it as a simple ratio, 1, colon, and the number. Notice that the comma between the 200,000 is not international standard. It's specific to the United States. So the international standard is to leave a gap between every third digit in large numbers. The reason for this is that the comma in Italy and France and a few other countries is used as what we use the decimal point for. So it's very easy to get people highly confused if we don't standardize numbers. We can put it as a fraction, 1/1/200,000. That's literally the multiplier. It's like you go to a hobby shop and buy a scale model of a car or a plane or something. It will be a specific size, you know, say one part in 80 or one part in 20. Everything will be scaled down by that same ratio. That's that ratio. We often abbreviate it. As I said, we often use Cardo slang that say things like 24K or 1 to 24K, or the 1 to 1 million map of the world was often called the millionth map, simply because that was the scale. And as I said, beware of periods and commas. It's very easy to lose track of where's the decimal place and how big the number is. We can give it as equivalent lengths. So in many early maps, almost exclusively in maps in the 18th and 19th century, they used simple equivalent lengths. So they would say the scale of this map is 1 inch to a mile. That's not a very convenient scale, you know, because there are 63,360 inches in a mile. That's not exactly one of those memorable numbers. I doubt there are very many people that even know how many feet there are in a mile. All right, there are a few in this class. You're in the right place, quite obviously. 5,280. Just why we've got these crazy multipliers, I'll talk about in just a second. Or we could say an inch to 2,000 feet. That's exactly 1 to 24,000. So those are often called 2,000-foot maps. Those are the standards that we use for mapping in the U.S. And the last way, which is sort of a parting thought here, is actually, in my mind, the most important way, the most significant way, and that's as a graphic. Okay, here are some graphic scales selected from maps. The top one, I can't read the text there, but it's in some unit or other, I forget. Typical graphic scales are often divided up in unusual ways. Okay, so let's familiarize ourselves with the ways they're divided up. Often we take some uniform increment. So this is 50, 100, 150, 200. It wouldn't make sense if this was 23.7 and so on. It would be a little bit difficult to use. And we divide it up into increments. There's a reason for this, which we'll meet in just a second. Look at this one. This is in both miles and kilometers. That's good. It gives us two different ways of measuring the same distance. But it has zero here. Okay, so zeros match up. And we go off in up to 100 kilometers here, which is about 60 miles. And then in the other way, we go off with finer increments along here. So whereas we've got every 20 kilometers along this axis, here we have every 5 kilometers. And again, there's a purpose for that. There's a logic for it. We've got equivalent up there, but done a little bit more graphically. Here's the scale from a USGS 1 to 24,000 series map. And you notice that here we've got pretty much everything. We've got a mile as increments and then as tenths on this side. We've got thousands of feet, same way. We've got them as increments here and then divided into hundreds of feet on this side of the scale. And down here we've got 1 kilometer, and then on this side we've divided it into increments of 100 meters or tenths of a kilometer. So complex looking scales, we'll see exactly why they're so complex in just a second. So there are some distinct advantages of using graphic scales, and I advocate them at all times because they solve a lot of problems. They can be used for direct measurements on the map. They can be used for the piece of paper trick, or the dividers trick. More about that in just a second. The nice thing about graphic scales is they're true at whatever enlargement or reduction you use on the map. Okay, so if I, for example, let's take a map. Say I have a map at 1 to 24,000. I put it through a scanner, now it's a digital image, and then I project that image up on the screen. Okay, it's not still at 1 to 24,000. The source map was at 1 to 24,000, but the display is going to be at actually a far more detailed scale than that. Notice I'm using more detailed, not smaller or larger. So, but that's not true of a graphic scale. If I scanned the map and it had the scale on it, as it did in the last slide, that same line would have been enlarged by exactly the same amount as the map. So it would still be correct. I could still use the graphic scale because it was enlarged by exactly the same amount that the map was. Okay. We can show different units. I just showed you an example that had miles and kilometers, but we can even do different increments. We had the miles, feet, and kilometers all on the single scale. But here's a bit of a problem. We cannot account for scale differences on the map. More about that in just a second. That's going to be highly related to projection. And the bottom line here is that where we put the scale on the map makes a difference. Okay, if we put it at the center of the map and take a measurement versus put it on the edge of the map, we might get different results. Or if we measure the same distance north-south versus the same distance east-west, we may get different results. More on that as we get into projections. So it may be directionally biased, and we can very often make a mistake like that. Here's an example of how we can deal with some of these problems. If you're into sailing, and many people are when they come to UCSB, you probably used one of these. It's called a universal plotting chart. You can buy these in any navigation store, any ocean-related store. And it's basically just a grid laid out with a compass so we can measure off lines going at different bearings and then transfer those lines over to any other point on the map. And we've got this curious device here. Okay, so this is a graphic scale. It's just like the ones I've just showed you. But the difference is that here it's marked off with latitudes. So the idea is you figure out what latitude you're at. We're at about 34 here. So you draw a line across at 34, and now that scale is going to be relevant to your map. Okay, so all the distances on that map are going to depend upon your latitude. So if we're going to mark out a particular course, do a particular sail from A to B, we would need to take that into account. So this is a very practical way of dealing with this difference, but it's not universal. It's called a universal plotting chart, but it's not actually that universal. Okay, I'm going to take a digression here and talk about units because they're extremely important when we talk about lengths and distances and scales. I've been doing some research since I'm writing the book into the history of units, and it seems like you go back past the Romans into the Greeks and the Etruscans and so on. There's a fair degree of standardization around units. Most of that standardization sort of fell apart when we reached the Middle Ages. And we reached a new set of standards for units. So all of the units that were originally used for surveying in the United States were imperial or British units. And that was actually a very close argument. The initial Congress was absolutely determined to use the meter as the basis for surveying in the United States. And it got fought out in Congress, and the imperial units won largely because the surveying had already started under British colonial times. So we ended up with this system that in Britain goes back at least to the ancient Romans, and more about that in a week or so. It's based on a bizarre set of units, the inch, which has remained, and a lot of these units are believed to be related to things that could be handily had in the field. So an inch is almost uniformly reckoned to be the length of the top length of your thumb, from the knuckle to the tip. Of course, some people have longer fingers and thumbs than others, but on average, it comes out to about an inch. The foot, we all have feet, and they're convenient for measuring. They're approximately 12 inches long, and the foot was not standardized for a very long time. Eventually, it was standardized, but you'd be surprised how recently it was. It was already into the 1800s before the idea of having a standard survey foot began to appear. The yard, I love the yard, it's a beauty. The yard was first standardized in, I believe, the 1300s as the length between King Henry's nose and the tip of his fingers. Okay, it'd be a little hard to go back and get the standard from which that measurement was taken these days. You'd have to dig him up. But that was the original basis for this, for the yard, and then it was set as 3 feet. The yard was used extensively by the Romans, where it was generally reckoned to be a pace, although almost every person's pace that I know is less than a yard. Then we start to go up into unusual units. The rod is half the length of the rod that you might carry to herd sheep. So it's generally about 16 feet, but it's shortened to 8 feet approximately. Beyond that comes the chain, and the chain is actually an extremely useful length. Originally it was the length of a rope, or the length of a Gunter's chain, a chain that could be pulled out at either end and used to measure off lengths. The chain, I would argue, is one of the most important units of measurement used in surveying the United States. You'll see why in a while. Then there's a unit that pretty much disappeared completely from everybody's liturgy, with one exception. That's in horse racing, and that's the furlong. We still maintain furlongs. Here's the 5-furlong marker on a race course. For some reason, they still use furlongs in horse racing. There's something about horses. They also use the hand for the height of a horse, the middle of its back. They still use that as a length. And then the mile, which does have roots back to Rome and even earlier than that. So that's the standard set of units on which we have. If you look at the multipliers as you go one to the next, we go 12 inches to a foot, 3 feet to a yard, and then it sort of falls about apart a little bit. It's 16 and a half feet to a rod, and we usually, rods were two rods, so you had half a rod. So it's a rod that was 8 feet, 2.5 inches long. That's the length of a long spear or something, I don't know. Then we jump up to 66 feet for the chain, and then 10 multiplier of 10 chains to a furlong, and 8 furlongs to a mile. So this gives us a mile at 5,280 feet, a number we'll meet a little bit later. Then, of course, as soon as we go into the oceans, these linear distances that are meant for measurement with things like chains don't work. You know, try measuring with chains on boats. Don't advise it. So we need units that are based upon, instead, latitude and longitude, and increments of 1 minute longitude and latitude relate directly to the nautical mile, which has been standardized. Been standardized at 6,076.11549 feet. Try measuring that level of detail in a boat again. Or 1,852 meters. So we've got that international nautical mile. We have the nautical mile as used in the United States, where it's rounded to 6,080 feet. And this corresponds to 1 minute of arc. That's 1 degree is 1 degree of latitude and longitude. A great arc is a circle that is formed by starting at the Earth's center and then choosing the circle that connects 2 points by the shortest segment. If we go along that great circle and divide the degrees into 60, we have minutes. And 1 minute of arc of a great circle on Earth is what we mean by a nautical mile. Okay, so that those are units for length. And I'm not, there are lots more good length stories, but I won't bother you with them. We also have to deal, of course, in cartography with not just linear lengths, but the three-dimensional form of the Earth's landscape. Okay, so we have heights as well. So here is, this is just last year, I got a trip to Denver, and I had half an afternoon free, so I said, I want to go to the state capitol because I know that on the state capitol steps are these markers, because we all know that Denver is known as the Mile High City, right? Why? Well, because the 5,280-foot elevation marker actually falls on the steps of the state capitol. So that's what I wanted to see. And when I got there, I found not one, but 3 different markers. Okay, this one says 1 mile above sea level, and there was clearly something once there, but it's gone. There's a bronze plaque up there that looks like that. It's now almost completely worn off, so you can't even see where the center of it is. And it's probably been polished too many times. And then there's a new one a little further down that I'm pointing to. It's several steps down the marker here. So the thing about distance is you have to know what you're measuring from, right? Well, Why different heights? They're all meant to be mile-high city, right? Well, remember what we were talking about datums in the last lecture. So we've got the three markers that identify the same point. You can see all three on this picture here. There's the lower one, the 1 mile above sea level one there, and then the next one. They're all on different steps. So why the differences? Well, the history works like this. The first marker was installed in 1909 on the 15th step, but was so frequently stolen that they replaced it with a engraved text that said 1 mile above sea level that was engraved in 1947. So there's probably a lot of them out there on eBay to be had, you know, where people stole the bronze plaque. So the second marker was placed in 1969 by Colorado State University engineering students on the 18th step after supposedly resurveying the elevation. Why on the 18th step? What had changed between 1909 and 1969? Well, NAD 27. Okay, we finally have an elevation datum from the United States that's different from mean sea level. So we're going to go up, we're going to basically set the zero to a new point. So all the elevations are going to be different. Still on the steps, fortunately, but not like in the lobby or something like that. And then a third marker was placed in 2003 after the new national vertical datum, the NAD 83, was put in place. So, and that determined that the 13th step was exactly 1 mile above sea level. Okay? So don't worry, sea level hasn't been changing that much over the last 100 years. Fortunately, it might in the next century. But you can see the importance of where you set zero to when we're doing these kinds of scaling or these kinds of measurements. We also, in geography, deal with areas, okay? And linear distance and area can sometimes get a little bit confusing. So if we go 1 foot by 1 foot, we have 1 square foot, 144 square inches. Now, an important thing, and you'd be amazed by who gets this wrong. Senior college staff and faculty get things like this wrong. 10 square feet is not the same as 10 feet square. Okay? 10 feet square, or 10 feet by 10 feet, is 100 square feet, not 10 square feet. Okay? And these values multiply up very quickly, and even faster when you go into volumes, when you go to third power. Okay? 9 square feet is 1 square yard. Cubic yard of soil is a significant amount of soil. I know, I've shifted it many times. Okay? And we can have other unusual distances for areas, like 160 square rods or 10 square chains. Okay, it might sound like ridiculous measurements, but this is what an acre is. Okay, this is how you measure out an acre. You measure off 10 chains by 10 chains. 640 acres, 1 square mile. Okay, very convenient as it begins to fall into place. 640 is a number that you can divide by many other numbers. Yeah. Just to set it all in context, you know, it being September and we're about to go into the playoffs and World Series and so on, I always like to think of the world in terms of baseball. It puts everything straight, especially now that the Yankees are going to definitely be in the playoffs. Baseball diamond around the base is 90 feet square. Okay. And it is a square, not a diamond. That's 8,100 square feet, or 752.49 square meters. Okay. Start thinking of distances and areas in metric is going to help you. We obviously saw that the imperial units are rather complicated. So thank goodness for the metric system, which has simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. The metric system is based on a meter, as we saw last time. The meter was originally defined as 1/10 millionth of the distance from the equator to the pole on the meridian that passes through Paris. We long since gave up that definition. For a long time, it was a solid bar of platinum or whatever it was in Paris, a copy of which was actually sent to the United States for Thomas Jefferson to use, but apparently he never made it. But now we have far more consistent definitions of a meter. We use particle physics now to define a meter. But basically, 1,000 small units, millimeter units, form a meter. 1,000 meters make a kilometer. So if we have 1,000 millimeters by 1,000 millimeters, we have a square meter. A square meter is a little bit less than the area of the surface of this table. Notice that the United States is the only country in the world that uses the spelling meter. The entire remainder of the world uses metre. There are actually only two countries in the world that do not use the metric system as their standard. Those are the United States and Libya. Go figure. All right. And then again, the important unit, 100 meters by 100 meters. Imagine a 100 meter dash in the Olympics, a long straight run. If you fold that out and make it an area, we have 100 meters by 100 meters. That makes a unit of area that in the metric system is called the hectare. The hectare then is 10,000 square meters. And again, note, 10 square meters is not 10 meters squared. A very important distinction. Okay, I think that's the end of my digression on units. Ah, yes, here it is. So this is where we do a little bit of audience participation. We'll call this a mantra. Okay, this is an extremely important sentence. So important that I can't distill it down any further than equation. So I think we should all recite it together. Okay, ready? On three. One, two, three. The representative fraction is the mat distance divided by the ground distance in the same units. Very simple, right? I found by trial and error an experiment that if we do this on a very elaborate, well in this case it's orange on here, but a very yellow background, we can institute what we call burn-in. Burn-in is if you stare at this long enough and close your eyes, you'll actually see the words written there in front of your eyes. Okay, so let's repeat it one more time. Things that I make you repeat are generally kind of like on exams and that sort of thing. Okay, on three, one, two, three. The representative fraction is the mat distance divided by the ground distance in the same units. What's the representative fraction? You don't have to tell me. Okay. I'll take your word for it now. In a formula, it looks like that. Representative fraction is the mat distance divided by the ground distance in the same units. So if one of those two is feet and the other one's meters, you've got a complex conversion. If one's feet and one's miles, you've got a complex conversion. So we have to deal with the units. And the nice thing about metric system is you have to deal with units that come in increments of 1,000, which makes life a lot simpler. Okay. How do we actually calculate scale from a map when we don't know the scale? Well, it has to do with measurement. Taking measurements from maps is called cartometry, and there's an entire discipline called cartometry that deals with these sorts of issues. Okay, generally speaking, we can take a ruler like that one. Notice that I haven't shown you the units that are on that ruler for now. We can take a feature like, say that cemetery or the nearest intersection point to the cemetery, and that place which looks like a bridge of a small road going underneath a railroad, and we can simply measure the distance off on the map. So that's calculating a map distance. Okay, and all we need to do then is have a map distance measurement and a ground distance measurement, and we can learn about the scale. So if we have known distances and we want to calculate the scale, we could do something like this. From the bridge to the cemetery on the map, it was 126 millimeters. Trust me, I didn't go out and measure it in the real world. I just used an online tool and found that it was 3,024 meters. So now all I have to do is recognize that meters and millimeters are not the same unit, but they are if I add three zeros to the end. So now I simply do a 126 divided by 302400, and that works out to 1 to 24,000, which is sort of reassuring because that actually was the scale of the map. So it always gets things correct. But we deal with all sorts of scales. Again, I'll return to my baseball theme here. Let's say we were using the Earth as a baseball, using a baseball rather as a globe. Highly inaccurate because of the seams, but let's just deal with that for now. So the circumference of the one that I measured for this class was 226 millimeters. We know that that circumference in the real world is 40 million meters. So we can calculate that the representative fraction just from using the formula I just gave you, is a 1 to 177 million. Again, something you can amaze your friends with during cocktail party conversation. We can calculate ground distances without actually measuring them if we have a map and we know its scale. I mean, that sounds sort of self-evident and obvious, but it is very important that we can do things like this. So what we're actually doing when we do this is using the map as a model of the real world. That's a very powerful thing to be able to do. It gives us the ability to make a calculation that might be difficult or even impossible to do on the landscape. So we've picked two points on the ground here. We want to calculate from the map scale the distance on the ground. So now we know the map distance, which we just measured. We know the map scale, which is 1 to 50,000 in this case. So we apply our representative fraction as the map distance divided by the ground distance in the same units. But we flip it around. We invert it. So now we're going to solve for ground distance. And 1 over the RF is the denominator, is simply the denominator of the map. And this is 50,000. So we multiply our 300 millimeters by 50,000. And we've calculated that that length must be 15,000 meters or 15 kilometers. Okay? Looks seemingly simple, but a really quite important thing to be able to do. We've measured a distance on the Earth's surface without ever having gone there. A far easier way to do it, but less accurate than actually making the measurement and doing the calculation, is to use the paper strip trick. Okay? And the paper strip trick works like this. You can use any piece of paper, an edge of your notebook would do, but nice thin strips of paper are generally better. And we can put the strip along the map at any given location. We can mark a point on here where we've got one line, mark a point where we come up to the other line. Now I can pick the strip up, do anything I like with it. One thing I could do is bring it down to my graphic scale. Okay, and a nice thing that I can do here is if I start at this, the top of this scale, I can take off whole increments of, say, miles until I get down to less than a mile. And then I can read off the other part that has the more fractional units, so I can get a more accurate reading on the last part of the undivided strip. So now you see what those graphic scales are actually for. They're for the paper strip trick. And they allow some surprisingly accurate measurements of distances to be made. The nice thing about the paper strip trick is that you can use it not just between two points, you can use it for almost anything. So here we're following a road, and we're simply taking the road and dividing it up between point A and point B. We're dividing it up into small segments, each one represented by these ticks. And by moving the paper around, I'm just transferring all of those ticks onto the paper. I might be following a railroad or a stream or going around the outside of a pond. Now I can simply take the strip, put it up to the scale, and make the same measurement. So I can measure things of arbitrary length on the map by using this paper strip trick. All right, so let's go for a tour of scales. Well, I gave you that set of scales at 1 to 1,000 versus when we came up to 1 to 40 million, that would be 1 meter across. 1 to 400 million, the Earth would be about the size of your fist, or a little bit smaller. 177 million would be the size of a baseball. So let's look at some scales. I'm not going to tell you the actual scales. What I've done here is I've gone into the seamless map viewer from the United States Geological Survey that allows you to go to any place in the country, zoom right in to as detailed as you can possibly get, and then look at things. And over on this side is a typical sort of zooming scale that you might have in Google Earth or Google Maps, where you just simply click on increments to go up and down. So this is sort of the internet equivalent of a representative fraction, but it's not telling you what it is. It's not giving you numbers. It's just giving you something to look at. Now, you may not realize it, but this little copse of trees and these few farm buildings and this very odd-shaped junction here, we'll return to the shape of this junction in a couple of weeks, is 3 kilometers northwest of Lebanon, Kansas. Anybody ever been to Lebanon, Kansas? Okay. Nobody would ever know Lebanon, Kansas. But according to the USGS, it is the geometric center of the United States. Okay, so if you zoom right in to the center of the map and take the default, you should end up there. And I've been down and looked around there on Google Street View, and there's not a heck of a lot there. Okay, so let's move over to the map representation rather than the image representation. As far as the map is concerned, we've got some lines, points, symbols, some text. Here's that farm building. There's a house. Wonder what it costs to buy the house that's the closest house to the geometric center of the United States. I'll bet it's a little bit less than Santa Barbara. Okay, what's happened here? I've hit one level of zoom out, actually two levels of zoom out. Okay, so my feature's still there. In the center, you can still see it. There's the two buildings, they're still there. But I'm beginning to move out. We couldn't see the quarry on the left-hand side on the previous image. And I've done this not just by changing the scale of the map. Okay, I'm going to continue to zoom out. This is one more zoom out. We're now at about 1 to 100,000 series maps. And now you see why I chose this point. It comes up as a symbol saying it's the geographic center of the 48 states. Sorry, Alaska and Hawaii not included here. We can still see the quarry. It's still marked. Our buildings have disappeared now. And larger scale features like streams and lakes are beginning to become more prominent. Let's keep going. Now I'm beginning to notice that it's in a landscape that's decidedly gridded, with roads following grid pattern. More about that in the weeks to come. Now I can see that there's actually some major roads like interstates and highways nearby. And these are all rather straight. And they continue to be straight in this part of Kansas. Now I begin to pick up some water features. Now I can even see the patchiness of the maps as they're linked together. Boom, now I lose all the local detail and all I can see is the highway map. I'm zoomed out now to original coverage. I'm looking at that. This is the entire state of, pretty much the entire state of Kansas being shown here. Nebraska above it, the place I'm looking at is fairly near the northern part of Kansas. Just go out. All I'm doing is clicking two steps at a time on the zoom. Out one more. I'm beginning to show the entire Midwest of the United States. Santa Barbara now appears on this map. I zoom out one more, and we can see the whole country. Okay. So I'm going. I was thinking about that movie as I was walking over here. Levels of 10, it was called. It's kind of the same thing. We can, as we increment and go up between scales, we can change the coverage, the extent, and also the level of detail. Through the scale. Okay, now one thing to point out here before we wrap up is that as we zoom in, we get new features. Okay, we couldn't see those two houses at the geometric center after we zoomed out a couple of levels. We didn't see the quarry at all at the most zoomed level. We only saw it when we got up to a scale of about 1 to 50,000. Now here's Isla Vista on Google Maps, zoomed in where we can see every single street, and all the streets are labeled. If I just zoom out a couple of levels here on the zoom scale, all the streets in Isla Vista disappear, and I've only got the major roads showing. Okay? So the point here is that the content, what we can actually fit on the map, is being adjusted to fit the scale of the map. Okay? Again, it's obvious until you point it out. So the content is scale specific. The other thing I'd like to point out here is that the map is relatively static over scale ranges. So if I'm here with every street showing and I zoom in a couple of levels, the same labels on the same streets are going to appear. There's not going to be any relative change across a series of zooms, and then eventually we're going to go to a different map. Okay, so we've got different maps stored at different levels. So as I said, scale stamps itself onto cartography, and it indeed does so. I just want to briefly mention this. This is the work of Cindy Brewer at Penn State, who's a cartographer who's been working with the USGS on their maps. And what she's done is she's gone through all the map scales that the USGS deals with, and you see the most detailed they have are 1 to 20,000, and they continue mapping up to scales at 1 to 1 million at the top here. And these are just the different features, like administrative boundaries, cultural features, populated places, airports, physical features like woodlands and hydro areas, streams and so on. And what you can see by these bars is that in this case we have the feature present on the most detailed map, but at some point that feature is just simply going to drop out. It's going to disappear. It's not going to be shown on the map at all. Okay, so the content of the map is scale specific. So scale, as I said, it's like a brand. It stamps itself onto the cartography and becomes very important, not just in measurement, but in symbolization. Okay, given all that I said about units and calculations and representative fractions, fortunately, most systematic map coverages choose a particular scale and then stick with it. In the United States, these are the scales that have been used for mapping. The country is continuous for the lower 48 states at 1 to 24,000. They decided to metrify them and made some of them at 1 to 25,000, but that wasn't continuous. At 1 to 50,000, the country, indeed the world, is complete by the what used to be the Defense Mapping Agency, now the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. At 1 to 100,000, it's complete, both from the Census Bureau in its TIGER files and from the USGS in its 1 to 100,000 coverage. We've got some maps at the legacy scale of 1 to 63,360, the old Ordnance Survey 1-inch to 1-mile scale, and they made an attempt to metrify those and decided it would be 1 to 62,500. That's the best scale at which Alaska is mapped. So almost all of Alaska is mapped at that scale. And then we generalize up, 250K, 500,000, and 1,000,000. These are the common scales. Actually, we'd have to add the National Atlas at 1 to 2,000,000 if we were going to fully flesh out that scale. All right, so here's my wrap up. A little bit over time, my apologies. The map scale transformation is the first transformation we're going to meet. It changes data about the Earth into a representation, set of symbols, at a particular scale. Don't use the terms large scale and small scale when you're around me in this class or doing exams, okay? Most maps lie between 1 to 1,000 and 1 to 400 million. At that scale, we're beginning to do astronomy and not geography. You all know the next one because you recited it. Paper map, the paper strip works. We're going to try it. Most maps use standardized scales like 1 to 50,000. And we think when we deal with maps on computers that scale doesn't matter. It does. Okay, I'll see you all on Friday.